Oh, so, sorry, were you asking me that, were you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't even know that word.
Yeah. Could be silent.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe, together with Guinness. Game changed.
Hello and welcome along to House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe and together with Guinness. I'm Emer Constein and I'm here with Ian Madigan. Ian, how has your weekend been? A different type of Halloween to the one that we usually would expect?
Yeah, it was good. Really looking forward to another show. Obviously, a slightly more quiet Halloween this year around. We had a few of our neighbours called over. We just left sweets out for them on the hall door, so they were still able to go trick-or-treating of some sorts. But no, there was no big partying our end. Still in lockdown here in Belfast. So what about you? Were you back in camp? Obviously, the French game was postponed, but what happened there?
Yeah, so obviously disappointing that the French game couldn't go ahead, but we had camp instead. And I actually had to text the girls just to make sure that there wasn't some sort of a dress-up, because you never know with like girls like Anna Capeless. Like, I just remember last year we were in France this time last year playing against France just over in a training camp, and we had a full-on dress-up day with the whole squad, and it was prizes and you played Halloween games and everything. But I was so scared coming into camp this weekend that I was going to be the fool that turned up with my IRFU kit on and no fancy dress. You know that fool that comes into school on non-uniform day wearing your uniform? Like, I thought that was going to be... So I just double checked, but nothing this weekend, but yeah, back in camp, which was good, and no fancy dress this time round. But yeah, like a very different Halloween that we usually have. Like, I actually noticed that when I came to Dublin, like I'm 10 years in Dublin at this stage, and Halloween just wasn't a big deal when I was growing up. Like, I lived in the middle of nowhere where you had to get a car from house to house because there was no street light. You couldn't walk out in the dark on your own. So you just got driven from house to house. And it's only when I moved to Dublin that I realized just how big of a deal that it is, and the fireworks and the bonfires and everything. And I'm sure that's what your life was growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That was one thing that was very good in Belfast. They know how to put on a good fireworks show. So we drove up kind of towards the Falls Road and had a good view of it looking out on Belfast. And there's no shortage of fireworks up here, that's for sure.
Have you any good, did you ever dress up like OTT or have like a really good dress up? Or are you into your Halloween fancy dress up?
Yeah, I probably wasn't massively into it growing up. More like just... self-confidence of not backing myself with a good outfit. But as time's gone on, more so in the time in Bristol, actually, there was a big culture there. Pat Lam loves a good dress-up, whether it's like a 70s theme night or even for Halloween dressing up and, get everyone together. Everyone makes a big effort.
Tell me a bit about that 70s theme. A little birdie sent me a little message of you looking well in a fancy dress outfit.
I think Anna might have sunk me there, but Pat was great for that. It was always like, you know, we work hard and train and stuff like that, but he'd always like to give a focus every couple of months of having a big night out. And we go down to the stadium in Ashton Gate with his like big function rooms, and there was, I think that photo there was from a 70s night, and you know, everyone went all out, like big wigs. Pat would be in his platform shoes, himself and Steph dressed up to the nines. And actually find like a night like that really brings the group together. And, there's a fair bit behind it because, you know, if you're making demands of guys in training or in games and you don't have a kind of personal relationship with them, it can kind of grind on them after a while. Whereas if you've got a kind of personal relationship with them and they kind of see the soft side to you, and you've had a bit of fun with them, you know, on a night out and a few pints, and they kind of see the softer side to you, they can be more receptive and vice versa. Like, guys can be more comfortable criticizing each other. And I think when you're complimenting a guy who you've a good relationship with off the back of a few good nights out, you know, it means more as opposed to just the words, you know. And I'm sure you girls have had a few good nights together that have brought you guys together.
Yeah, like it is. It's the stuff off the field that really bonds you, whether it's a Halloween dress up or whether it's, you know, those nights out after the games. And like, there isn't very many, like obviously in last week's show, you know, you have to go to work the next day. So the going out thing isn't, it's only really end of season. And I think one example was last year, you know, we had a really disappointing Six Nations last year. And what really showed us as a squad is, you know, when things are going bad and when people are annoyed and pissed off their performances and how we did as a squad, what really shows the squad is when everyone goes out together. Like, you know, it's easy for people to go in twos and threes and go their own way and have a moan about what should have happened. But that night after the Welsh game, we flew back and that not one person was missing. The girls that were injured, the girls that hadn't travelled over to Wales, the girls that had played and had played badly or, you know, were disappointed. Not one person was missing that night. And I think that's what shows as well, is that those nights are as important as the ones that you win to. You know, you win together, you lose together. And it just, yeah, culture is one thing that, you know, you can do all the training you can and you want in the world. But when it comes to actually getting out in the field, you want to have that girl's back or that guy's back beside you. And going on those nights out, you know, really, really does make or break a team. And I think it's shown to us this year, and it's standed to us this year, it's stood to us this year, and how well that is, how well those work. That can be edited, that bit.
But no, it's funny. I was actually only talking to a few of the guys about it during the week. And like, obviously with the restrictions that we're under, it's something that we're really missing. Like even, you know, 5-6 lads going to a coffee shop, you know, going around to one of the guys' houses and playing pool or playing darts for a night, going for a few beers, you know, out on the town after a good win or whatever it might be. It just, it kind of creates an atmosphere within the squad. You know, you're coming in, back in on a Monday morning, and, you know, there's a bit of fun about what had happened on the night out or, you know, what forfeits guys had to do playing darts or playing pool. And, yeah, look, it's a shame that we can't do that. But I suppose as well, you do see you see guys adapting and being able to, you know, create their fun in a different way. I'm sure you guys have been doing things similar.
Yeah, we are, and look, that's so important in what you said there about not being able to go over to those houses. Just chatting to CJ Stander earlier on a bonus episode of the podcast, you know, he was saying how difficult it was for him to come to Munster, one, not knowing the language. And I was like, what was it? You know, what was it that made the transition easier? And he said it was, I suppose, the community and the squad and getting to know the guys, and not just getting to know them on the field, but getting to know them and going to each other's houses and actually, you know, meeting their families. It's not just about the person. There's a lot more to the person than just the rugby player. And it must be very hard for players. Like, did you find, I suppose you're a new player this year with Ulster and coming in the middle of a pandemic, like what it probably is a little bit different. I suppose the restrictions weren't as hard or as tough up north early on when you arrived. But, you know, for new players coming down, I suppose, to any of the provinces this year, it must be a difficult transition and not having that social element to, I suppose, really gel with the team.
Yeah, certainly. Like it's not as testing on me because I'm still in around the team, you know, and, you know, the stuff going on there. But I think it is challenging on the partners. Like, I know for Anna, like, there's certainly not enough as much stuff. Like, you know, they'd meet up with the girls around game time, you know, and even for an away game, you know, a lot of the time they'd go over to one of the girls' houses and watch it there. And that kind of, you know, the matches give them a focus in the week as well. And that's really important because, you know, they kind of live the good times and the bad times with us. And it's very important that they get to enjoy games and enjoy getting together and having a few drinks. So, yeah, look, it has been tough, but, you know, you just adapt to it and get through it, I suppose.
Exactly. So anyway, I think we're putting off talking about the rugby long enough. We have a great show lined up. We have one of the world's top referees, Nigel Owens, coming on for a chat later. We're looking forward to that, Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. Big fan of Nigel, both as a referee. You know, he's always a very fair ref. I think he protects the players really well and adds a bit of humour in there along the way, which is always welcome. But also as a person, you know, a huge amount of respect for Nigel for how he conducts himself. And yeah, really looking forward to catching up with him on the show.
So I suppose we have to just pull the plaster off and get into that Ireland defeat to France and England winning that 2020 Guinness Six Nations Champions. I suppose before we get on to the Irish squad, I suppose talk about France and, you know, how deserving they were of that win at the weekend.
Yeah, look, very, very good performance from France. I think unlike previous French sides, we saw how patient they were in the game, and any small mistakes Ireland made, France were there ready to pounce on them. I think their ability to up the tempo at key times in the game, like they came out after after half time. You know, it was a great first half by Ireland. The game was really in the balance. But they just seemed to just, you know, up the tempo. Anytime someone made a break, there was guys flooding through right on their shoulders. Don't think anyone's running a better support line than DuPont at the moment. You know, everything that guy touches turns to gold. You know, we played against him in Toulouse a few weeks ago, and he was phenomenal there. You know, we tried to have a few little plays to kind of trap him in and trick him, and he just, you know, found a way to wriggle out a few times. He's just a tough man to keep contained. But I'm sure you're impressed with some of the back three for France. You know, Fiku moving from the centre to the wing was a bit of a masterstroke.
Yeah, like last week, I think we had predicted Fiku and Vaktela to be in the centre, and even in the centre, we, you know, they were going to cause trouble. But Fiku proved to be trouble on the wing. You know, it wasn't just his ball carrying ability; it was his kick over the top. It was his offload for Dupont's try. It was, you know, he was just involved in so much of their play. And last weekend on the podcast, we spoke about Entomac and Dupont and Vaktela, and you know, they were the three guys that ended up essentially getting those three tries in the end. And they're just, I suppose Ireland weren't able to deal with their flair for a finish. And so as we spoke about their counter-attack and how important it was that we had a good line chase and that our kicks were really accurate. And I suppose both of those things didn't really happen, which allowed them in the back three to show off the flair that they have and show off the skills. And unfortunately, they did do that. And we didn't come out, I suppose, on the good side of it. But so the Entomac is one of those key players that, and the relationship that he has with Dupont from playing at club level, like you can evidently see it. And it's just crazy to think at how young both of those guys are and what a future that they have ahead of them, both at, I suppose, a club and at international level.
Yeah, certainly. I was really impressed with Entomac. You know, that little chip towards the end was just phenomenal. Yeah. Like, he's dropped it onto his, you know, perceived bad foot, weighted it perfectly, gathered it up, accelerated it away, and just, you know, gifted a try to one of his teammates. It was just pure class, really.
If that's something you try and train him, like, I don't.
Yeah. Like, I know. The chip and chase is something I think we've seen come back in the last few weeks. Obviously, Finn Russell's a master at it.
Johnny tried it, didn't work out.
Gibson Park did it, that worked. But no, it's I think obviously teams are very hard to break down defensively at the moment, but you know, I think the video analysts and coaches have identified that space between, you know, the defenders in the backfield and the frontline defence that are more than ever moving forward with real speed. So if you can chip it over them, because they're moving forward with such speed, it's very hard for them to turn and get back on the ball. So no, look, it's definitely a good thing for the attack to be winning, you know, in a game that's, I suppose, running out of space.
So along with the French flair that we saw, and, you know, we knew France were going to play with that type of style in that offloading game and with a bit of flair, and we did see it. But along with that comes, I suppose, you have to take the good with the bad. And talks to the penalty tries, you know, both on Ireland and on the French side of things, there was two penalty tries. Would you have done the exact same thing if you were in both of those positions?
Yeah, well, I think the Hugo Keenan one was an interesting one. Now, I don't think he was going to score because, you know, he's right there.
Yeah. But
I think it was really poor knowledge from the 15 from France to not realize that it was going to be a knock on. All he had to do was touch the ball. He didn't need to regather it, and it would have been a knock on. But with those moments of madness, you also get brilliance. And, you know, we saw that later in the game. I thought he was fantastic at the back. The one with, that was the penalty try against Ireland. Oh, I think if I'm in Doris's position, I'm probably still dragging him down. And you're kind of hoping that he could get away, that he was trying to gather the ball as you did it. But I think, you know, everyone's in no doubt that try was going to be scored if Doris hadn't tripped him up.
Yeah, 100% it was. And I suppose that was, I spoke really highly of Stockdale last weekend on how I really thought he was a great player and notable, you know, going to do well in that 15 position. And people just have those days, you know, especially as a fullback, and the conditions where, you know, I'm totally standing up for him here as a 15 who's played in crappy conditions with a slippery ball. But, you know, it's, yes, he probably should have done better to gather that, but these things happen and those mistakes. And you know, he did well in the end to finally finish out the game with the try. But, you know, there's no point in, I suppose, knocking a player when they're down either. And he's young, he's only played two international games in that position. You know, it's not as if he has a lifetime of experience. He's a young player, and you have to develop on these young players, I feel, and not just, you know, next. It's not like a conveyor belt of players, and people will never get it right first time. But we'll move on to...
You're right on Jacob there. And, you know, the mistakes he's made there, if someone else covers for him and tries aren't scored off the back of it, it's nothing as big a deal. You know, the one that Dar... Like, it's a big deal because Doris has tripped him up, Simbin, penalty try. If that had been regathered by someone and had been kicked 50 metres down the field, you know, it's not a big issue. You know, it's forgotten about very quickly. And I think people have to realise that, you know, games can unfold in a certain way that can be really lucky for a player, and you can make a few breaks, score some tries, and everyone thinks you're brilliant. And you can also be unlucky. You know, you can be put in a tricky situation. A bouncing ball doesn't go your way. And, you know, it probably was one of those nights for Jacob. But I also thought on the balance of things, he did some fantastic stuff as well. His kicking was excellent again. The try he scored at the end of the game was brilliant. And, you know, you're not suddenly a bad player off the back of making a few individual mistakes. And he's definitely a guy going forward that I know Ulster need to stand by, and certainly Ireland do, because, you know, he is a world-class player. And, you know, I'm sure we'll see that during the Autumn Nations Cup.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting what you said there. If someone had covered his ass, like, on that line, no one would have remembered that he didn't dive on that ball or that try was scored. And I'm just thinking back to this year, and I thank Lauren Delaney for my life this day. We played England over in England, our last game of the Six Nations, before COVID happened. And they hoofed the ball down the field. There was nobody there but me. And there was a really bad wind that day. And I completely, like, completely misjudged it. And you know those ones where your hands are out and you're like, oh, my God, I'm completely in the wrong position for this. But you were too late to adjust your feet. It went straight through my hands, straight through my legs. And whatever way it happened, the bounce, perfect top of her tail bounce all the way as far as the 5 meter line, all the way back down. If I didn't have Lauren Delaney cover my ass that day, it was a worse result for us. And it would have been completely my own fault, like, just judged it badly. So I can see how it can happen. And you know, depending on the conditions as well. And it was pretty slippy out there for Stockdale. But I suppose a lot of people are talking about the key moments in games. And I think it's very hard as a player personally to judge when to make these decisions. And when you're on the field, you know, you've so much adrenaline, you've so much going on, you're talking, you're focusing on your next job, and it's very hard to see the bigger picture. I think us on the outside as analysts, or as, you know, watching on the TV screen, we can see a lot more and you have time to pause it and stuff. But in the heat of moment, you know, as a 10, how easy it is to make those decisions. And I think people are criticising the Irish team for kicking to touch. But, you know, you have to try things, I suppose.
Yeah, certainly. Like, we played Cardiff last night. Now, I wasn't playing, but or a Monday night. And we'd had, like, loads of possession in the first half and hadn't really got the points on the board. We got one kick, they got a try. So we were 7-3 down, but we'd had the lion's share of possession. And Cardiff were a really good side. And you kind of got the sense that we needed more on the scoreboard than three more points. We'd had another kind of 7 or 8 minutes of pressure on their line towards the end of the first half. And you could just sense on the pitch that the players knew that 3 points and going in at 7-6, you know, while it was going to be a tight result at halftime, it wasn't enough for the pressure that we had. I mean, you're playing good sides. The momentum is always going to swing at some stage. I think Johnny probably felt that, and he probably felt, look, we've had a good bit of pressure, lots of territory in the first half, and we haven't got as much points on the board as we should have. And he probably felt that, look, we need 5 or 7 points, which I actually think would have been deserved of the scoreboard at halftime in that game. And look, he's been brave enough to go to the corner. I actually think it was a very poor decision on halftime by the ref. I think it was like clear hands on the deck there. And, you know, if that's a penalty 5 yards out and they tap and go again, we saw what, you know, Cian Healy did, you know, a good latch from James Ryan. He gets over for a try. There's nothing saying that couldn't have been done again. And, you know, it's a very different atmosphere in the change room if you've scored at halftime there going in. You know, the French are beginning to doubt themselves. The Irish are full of confidence. And I definitely think the start that France got in the second half would have been very different if you know, Ireland had got over the line for a try. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. I'm sure you've been in plenty of situations in games where you feel, you know, we need more than seven here, or, you know, maybe three is enough. Maybe three will break a team.
Yeah, and I suppose it's up to those decision makers and those key decision makers on the field. Like, not everyone is going to have their input. And I suppose once you go with it, and like that, what Andy Farrell said, you know, he's not the one making decisions on the field. Like, once we step over that whitewash, the decision is completely in our hands and in our captain's hands and in our decision makers' hands. And Johnny Sexton backed himself. And I suppose you have to back yourself and go for these things. And look, it won't always work out, but so that's just the nature of the game in that sport. So the positive thing is there was some really good performances from Ireland through this whole Six Nations campaign. I suppose notably CJ Stander getting nominated as one of the nominees for Guinness Player of the Championship. And he again was a standout player at the weekend, I thought. What did you think, from an Irish perspective, had a really good Six Nations or had a really good game at the weekend?
Yeah, certainly. Like, for CJ now to still be getting the turnovers he's getting, like, the scouting that's done on him before games is, look, anytime this guy's near a breakdown, take him out. Because he is just so good. His, you know, his body height, his ability to get on the ball and stay on it is incredible. And, like, be guaranteed the French had marked their card for him at the weekend, yet he still came up with probably three, four, or five turnovers, which was huge. In a team that was, you know, probably struggling a bit physically, he really stepped up and ultimately, like, gave Ireland an opportunity. Like, you know, we were, what, 6 points down, and he gets a great turnover on halfway. We go to the corner. We didn't win the line out. You know, they're the opportunities that CJ presents you with. You know, I thought he was fantastic. I thought James Ryan really stepped up. You know, he went through a serious body of work. He just seemed to be everywhere. And look, there was plenty of other good performances. You know, I thought Keane Healy was very good in the first half. The scrum stood up well. I thought, you know, Andrew Porter is someone who's really grown into that role, and it would be very interesting, you know, seeing Ty coming back in and having two quality options, you know, there to compete against each other. And then in the backs, you know, Robbie's try was an absolute moment of brilliance. You know, if we go on and win that game, he's probably the hero for getting Ireland back into it. You know, and I thought he'd lots of nice touches throughout the game. So there's loads of positives there. You know, there's nothing, I personally don't think there's anything broken with the game. You know, there's just a few things that I'm sure they'll tidy up in the coming weeks. And, you know, we might see some younger guys getting blooded throughout these autumn internationals. And, you know,
who are you thinking in relation to, you know, who do you, I suppose from an Ulster perspective or just from a general perspective, who do we think will be those young guys looking to be called in?
Yeah, well, I think obviously James Lowe has been in camp, so I'm sure he's in their plans to definitely get a look at him. From an Ulster perspective, you know, there's some real good quality younger backs coming through. The likes of Mike Lowry on Monday night scored another brilliant try. He's, you know, really exciting player. James Hume, who, you know, really stepped up against Leinster in the final of the league at the end of last season. And, you know, even someone like Robbie Little, who offers something a bit different. You know, he's kind of an electric back three, can play anywhere across there. There are three guys who, you know, I think will definitely be in the Ireland picture in years to come. But, you know, why not get a look at, you know, the likes of them against, you know, a perceived weaker opposition like Georgia? Who would you like to see coming in?
Yeah, I suppose focusing on the Munster part of it, you know, there's a lot of guys that have stood up for Munster in the last few weeks. Jack O'Donoghue, who has been in with Ireland quite a bit, but has never actually got that much. I'm not sure if he's captive, but he's got that much game time. But, you know, he's been playing very well for Munster. And player of the match performance last weekend. Craig Casey, again, I suppose, in the Pro 14 at the weekend over Dragons, you know, another man of the match for him. He's been in with the squad training. So I suppose to get that you know, experience coming in and being able to train with the squad. And as CJ was saying this morning, like, he's setting standards. And for CJ, or for someone like CJ to say that, you know, that's phenomenal that someone of Craig Casey's age is setting those standards. So look, there's plenty. The future is bright, and I think that's the positive with it. You know, Andy Farrell will have plenty to talk about, and he'll have plenty of headaches in relation to discussing the upcoming Autumn Nations. Right, great stuff. We'll be back for part two with Nigel Owens.
House of Rugby Ireland, here on Joe, together with Guinness. Game changed.
Okay, and you are all very welcome back to part two of House of Rugby here. A massive House of Rugby welcome here to Nigel Owens. Nigel, you were worth the wait tonight. You had a busy evening.
Yeah, apologies for the wait. I was supposed to get a delivery of putting a shed up the farm. It's supposed to come around 1 o'clock. It didn't come till 4 o'clock. So hence the panic. And I've just half done the cows now and fed them. So I don't have to go back out to do them now when I'm finished here. Yeah, so it's been a nightmare. So apologies for the wait.
Don't worry about that, Nigel. It's great to have you on the show.
Good to see you again, Ian.
Yeah, likewise. I think we might be bumping into each other this weekend.
Yeah, he will be. I'll be over for Ulster Glasgow. Is it on Monday night? Yeah.
Monday night.
Yes.
Should be a good one.
Yeah. Quite enjoyable, actually, the Monday nights to watch. Like, you know, I don't know what it's like to. I haven't refereed it on a Monday night or to play, you know, on a Monday night. But as a spectator, you know, there's nothing on a Monday night because everybody's bored on a Monday night. So it's good. You know, I watched two games last night, your game and then the Leinster-Glasgow game as well, like, you know, so it's good. Yeah, it's good to watch on Monday night, definitely.
Yeah, you kind of, because we've never really had Monday games before, you nearly lose track of the days, you know, like you get to a Friday and then you've the Saturday off as your weekday off, which would usually be probably a Wednesday or a Thursday, you know, and then even after the game, today off being a Tuesday, which is unusual. But I think it's good that there's like a run of four games and you kind of get used to it that way.
Yeah, no, definitely.
We on House of Rugby have our Hall of Fame, and every week we ask some of our Facebook members and some of our online members what kind of questions they would like to ask our guests. So for those questions, the latest inductees to our Guinness House of Rugby Hall of Fame are Margaret Hall and Jay Long. Well done to you both. So this week we have two questions. We're going to start you off straight away with some questions from our Facebook members. The first question, so they start off pretty difficult. Who is the rudest player that Nigel has reffed? So this question came in from Margaret Hall. So who is the rudest rugby player that you have reffed? So you can tell the truth or you can tell a few lies here.
Are you sitting next door to you there?
To be honest,
I don't think I've come across anybody really rude, really. You know, some a bit different to the others. You find some... they won't say much on the field, but I wouldn't come across as any rude, but really, maybe a few chopsy ones over the years. Stringer always has something to say, and then O'Gara will be piping up with him as well. Then
the monster men here.
Yeah, then Johnny Sexton took over from O'Gara, and God, Ian is an angel compared to them. But no, it's, you know, I honestly, there's nobody I would say that I disliked refereeing, you know, no, there wouldn't be, to be honest. There's honestly not.
Well, you're not going to name them anyway, name and shame, but
I don't have anybody to name, to be honest. I've always felt, look, you know, some people are just different to the others. Some people don't say much, but no, I wouldn't say that I come across anybody rude. No, certainly not on the field anyway.
I suppose that's the great thing with rugby is that respect for the referee. The second question came from Jay Long, and he asked, are there any changes to the game that you would like to see try to jazz up the game for the casual observer?
I think you got to be careful when you sort of want to change the game and sort of make it a game where you think everybody in the world wants to sit down and watch it. It's quite a unique game, rugby, and it's quite a complex game. And unless you go in to change the laws and make rugby totally unrecognizable to other game that we're used to, then there's not much you can do, really. There's little things you can change. They've made some changes now this year around the contact area. There's always quite a few changes made on safety grounds more than anything else, really. But I think the one thing for me that I would like to see happen, and I think it would contribute to a game being a bit more open, and that would be reduce the amount of substitutions. I think eight on the bench is far too many. And, you know, when you have eight coming on or 16 coming on from the both teams, you have a stop, start, second half, stop, sub on, stop, sub off. And I think as well, you know, imagine you've been playing your guts out for 60 minutes and all of a sudden they bring on a prop opposite you who's fresh and then you've got a scrimmage against him for the next 20 minutes. So I think it would help with player fatigue a bit because then the spaces will open up a bit more. There'll be a bit more gaps for people to get through. You won't also have a guy who's been playing for 60 minutes, you know, little bit tired, and then all of a sudden he's got to play up against somebody who's come on with a fresh pair of legs. So whether that, you know, it becomes unsafe and stuff, I don't know. You'd have to look at the all these sort of stats and how they look into these stuff on player safety. But I certainly would like to see the amount of substitutions reduced, to be honest. Yeah, reduced, right. At least from 8 down to at least 5, you know, maybe even 4.
I think that's a really interesting one. Obviously, you know, you need to have substitutes there to replace injured guys. But it's the tactical substitution of a fresh front row coming on, you know, or even, you know, two fresh back rowers coming on who are big carriers of the ball. I think for me personally, I'd be interested to know what you think, Nige, because obviously you're well known as a good referee, but also I think you're a big advocate of player safety, and it's something that you referee very closely. But for me, like, as one of the smaller guys out there, at around kind of 90 kilos, I personally don't like the pre-latch. You know, I think, you know, the South Africans were probably the ones who brought it in, and obviously it's made its way over to our hemisphere. But, you know, when you've got like two guys who are 110, 120 kilos doubling their weight before contact, it's just, you know, a huge mass to take through, you know, for the smaller guys. You know, I don't mind it if you're doubling their body weight once contact has been made. But I was interested to kind of get your thoughts on that.
That's a good point, really. And that's something I sort of brought up in a few discussions with people around, because they were looking at the latch, particularly when it goes to ground, and then the latcher then stays on the ball carrier, preventing a contest. So they were looking at that, and there was a discussion going around of whether they could make it illegal for a player to latch on to the ball carrier, you know, before a tackle is made, or an attempted tackle is made.
Yeah.
But then the interesting point, which I hadn't thought about until it came in the part of the discussion, was that because so many of the tackles now are 2-on-1, then it makes it unfair then for the ball carrier. If you're going to have two defenders tackling the ball carrier, then should the ball carrier then be entitled to... So imagine you had the ball and you've got... You know, what you said is a quite value point there, that if you're going to tackling two big South African guys who have latched on, it's one hell of a job to do. But then put it the other way then, you know, imagine if you're the ball carrier, then you've got another player latched on to you, and then you have somebody having to tackle you. So that's, I think, the reason why they haven't changed it, and whether they will change it, I don't know. So it's very interesting when you talk about changing the laws and stuff. You know, everybody comes up with a good idea, and then when you think about it, you think, oh, hang on, I didn't think of that. So I can see why now it would be difficult maybe to make the latcher illegal, because would you then be having to make a 2-on-1 tackle illegal, you know?
No,
there's something that has to be discussed, I think,
What about you, Emer? Were there any rules that you'd like to see change, maybe so you could get your hands on the ball a bit more out in the wing?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I suppose as a winger fullback, you know, you want the ball to come out to you as often as possible. And I was looking about being more restrictive around the scrums in relation to the scrum half and taking them out of the defensive line, or even bringing the scrum back a bit further so that there is an advantage to the attacking team of having that scrum. But what would you make about being more restrictive with the nine and taking them, you know, just solely 9-on-9 as opposed to being able to shoot off onto the 10-12 channel?
Oh, sorry, were you asking me that, were you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't even know the rule.
Complete silence. I'm not sure really about that, to be honest. So what do you mean from the scrum that the... What did you mean again?
I think what we're finding now in the game a lot of the time is, like, at the scrum, you know, obviously it's a big opportunity for backs to attack, and the scrum half is able to shut it down at source too often, you know. And I think, you know, maybe if there was more restrictive laws brought in around... You know, but... Again,
so the scrum half couldn't sort of follow around and be behind the ball harassing the other opposition scrum half?
Instead of it being a meter, maybe 2 meters or 3 meters, you know, or, you know, they have to stay within the scrum until the ball is gone, or, you know, just I think the rules, they're definitely bending the rules a lot, the nines. You know, they're getting around and being able to stop it at source. And I think it's probably something that we'd share, that maybe to have tighter rules around them. But it'd be interesting to see, hear your view on that.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure. As I said earlier, when you sort of discuss about changing a law, you've got to think, well, what's the knock-on effect then? What would happen if that was part of the law? And I'm not quite sure if there's anything negative about that, really, to be honest, if you change that. I suppose the only thing maybe is that nine wouldn't bother chasing that nine round. So what you have then, you'll have an extra man in back in defence, maybe. He'd go back to defend in midfield. So would that block down the space a bit, maybe? Whereas at least if he's harassing the nine, he's not able to go back and defend with the outside half against the outside half, you know? So apart from that, I don't really see that. I don't think there'd be any sort of downside from it, really, to be honest. Apart from just you being able to sort of defend on that line, I guess. That would be the only thing, maybe. It would be an extra man in defence line, 5 metres back, maybe, if they were allowed to do that, which a lot of them do anyway.
I think that's interesting. You know, we look at it one way, but then when you flip it around and look at the defence, what could happen? And when you actually dissect what could happen with the different laws, and similar to what Ian said about, you know, the double tackle as opposed to the latch, you know, when you actually dissect them down, there's a lot more thought that needs to go into all these different law changes.
That's why trialing them are hugely important. And again, you've got to remember that if you trial a law in a university, like in Stellenbosch, when they trial stuff there in that competition in that university, universities under 21s, they play a very different type of rugby than a national team going to win for the Six Nations or in the World Cup. So you've got to be careful when you trial things as well, because although things, I remember, when you were reffing under 20s or under 21s, when I was reffing in that tournament, basically, if you tell the under 21s, like, this is the law, this is what you need to do, then they do it. Yeah, and when they play against the senior side, it's very, very different. And I remember somebody asking about, reducing the penalty from 3 points to 2 points, because it would then mean, they'd go for tries more. And everybody goes, oh, why? That's a good idea, actually. Then we'll have more tries and less penalties. And then I said, well, yeah, hang on now. If what do you think a defence is going to do if they think by giving a penalty away, they're going to be giving 2 points away, rather than giving 7 points away? So if you reduce the penalty to 2 points, I would think the defence are going to be more prepared to give a penalty away, because they're only giving 2 points away rather than 7 points away. So, I didn't think of that. So it is, you really have to think laws through and trial them properly before you bring them in, because there will be an effect somewhere in the game. But if the positive is outweigh the negatives, then obviously that law change is a good law change. But most of the law changes now tend to be around the safety of the game, a lot of them, anyway.
For sure. There's a lot of talk, Nigel, about the offside rule and kind of the discrepancies between it. And is it a hard one? Is that probably one of the hardest ones to keep an eye on? Would you be depending on your touch judges quite a bit?
Yeah, you would. It is very difficult. Probably one of the most difficult ones to referee now is the maul as well. The maul setup and defence of the maul is very difficult, because you just have so many people together. Do they come to the middle? Do they unbind? Who took it down? Did the attacking team go to ground to prevent them holding it up for a turnover, or did the defensive team take it down? The offside contact area is always difficult, obviously. The space is very difficult, because when you go into a game and you sometimes look at the team sheets and you think they've got two open sides in the back row and the opposition have got two open sides, there's going to be a huge contest around that contact area. They are going to scrap for every possession of the ball. So your focus as a referee is going to get that contact area clean, make sure the tackler moves, the arriving players on the feet, the jackal releases before he gets back on the ball, that you reward them only if they're on their feet and there's been a clear release and stuff. So your focus is that. Only then, when you've cleared that, then you focus then on the offside line. But by that time, the ball may be coming away. So you rely on your assistant referees to help you with that. But the difficulty then for the assistant referee is, when you're 40 yards away, 50 yards away, you've got to know when the ball is lifted off the ground, it means that the ruck is over. So if you're onside, you're able to come up. So then the assistant referee's got to judge then, was that ball off the ground or not, before they came up or after they came up. So it is very, very difficult. So I think as a referee, you need to be focusing on that offside yourself as well, and not just leave it for the assistant referees. What you want for the assistant referees to do is to back you up if you miss something. My philosophy when I referee is I'll try and get everything I can myself. I know it's humanly impossible not to do that, but I try and get everything myself. And then if you do that, and then the assistant referee can sweep up behind you when you were looking, that's checking that side, and all of a sudden something happens this side. And that's what you want the assistant referees to do, not to rely too much on them. But you certainly do need a sixth pair of eyes now on the field, plus obviously an extra pair of eyes then with the TMO as well.
Nigel, you spoke about refereeing them all and how difficult it is. Did you happen to see the Munster Dragons game at the weekend where they never engaged in them all? Has anything like that happened before while you're reffing? Just bizarre scenarios where neither team do anything.
No, I heard about that, but I didn't watch that game. It's happened before. Some of this is our fault as referees if we don't referee the area well enough. So what happened was in the past, and probably creeping back into the game now, is if the mall is if we're not strict enough in refereeing a legal setup of the mall, the defensive side then has the attitude, well, we can't defend this mall because they're illegal. So they're setting bodies in front. They're obstructing. We can't get the ball carrier. It's undefendable. We can't defend the mall. So what they look then to do is other ways. And the other way then was not to engage in the mall, was to stand off. So the first thing you have to do as a referee is make sure that they don't step off the line. You've got to stay on that line. You can't leave the line until the mall is over, or until the liner is over. So I have seen it quite a few times in the past where they just stay there, and then they hope then that the attacking team is going to have the ball at the back, which becomes obstruction. Or if they have a ball at the front, then they'll try and tackle the first guy going in. So, yeah, I have heard about that. When there was a bit of a long standoff. I haven't come across one as long as that before, but I have come across it a few times when the defence just don't want to engage because they're looking to get a scrum or a penalty or something from it, because they probably feel, well, otherwise we're not going to be able to defend it.
Very good. Nigel, have you any memories of reffing Ian, or any stories to tell, or Ian vice versa, any funny moments of the two of you on the pitch?
No, I've reffed him many, many times over the years, and I've got to say it's always been a pleasure. Not because he's there now, it always has been. I don't think there's any. Well, you probably remember something now.
I know there's never anything too dramatic, but I find no. The respect the players have for you, Nigel, is huge. You know, for me personally, when I see you're a ref for a game, I just know it's going to be a game that's probably going to flow well and it's going to be ref fairly. And, you know, there'll probably be a bit of fun along the way as well. It's one of those ones. I think, you know, as a player and a ref throughout the years that I've played, you definitely build a relationship with referees as you go along. And I think there's a mutual respect there now, you know, and even the first question you got on the podcast, you know, has there been any, you know, rudeness towards you? And for the times that I've been playing, I haven't seen rudeness towards referees at all. You know, it's one of the great things.
I think that's because, as you said, it's the respect that the game has, like, you know, and it wouldn't be allowed, you know, that the captain or the other players in the team would prevent that happening if it did happen. So, no, that's what I was saying earlier, that there hasn't been any rudeness. Yeah, there's obviously some players who don't like a decision or not happy with you refereeing a game, and, you know, they'll be very reluctantly shake your hands afterwards or won't even bother shaking your hand, you know. And that's fine, but it's in the heat of the moment. But, as far as rudeness goes, no. And, Ian was always a pleasure. He's very... gets on with the game, you know. He doesn't sort of no dramas, no waving the arms, you know, no chasing the referee. So
just want to do that for the weekend.
Yeah, we do Monday night now.
Oh yeah,
want to do this next week as well, just in case things change.
I suppose, Nigel, just to get away from the rugby side of things, but also staying in the lines of it, you've spoken so openly and so strongly and so powerfully about coming out and your experiences around that. But so last week, Dan Palmer, the Australian rugby player, spoke so openly about coming out. And I suppose you have so much to like be thankful for and be, you know, people, you've provided this opportunity for so many people to be able to do this in such a public forum. And I don't know, do you understand the effect and the influence that you've had on people so positively?
Yeah. I suppose I do now. Yeah, because I do a lot of talks around LGBT stuff and mental health stuff and things like that. And you know, you get so many people coming up to you afterwards, or people getting in touch with you and saying that they heard your story or they read your story and it's helped them a lot. So I am quite aware of that. It's not the reason why I talk about. It's not the reason why I came out. I came out with my own mental health and well being. And the reason I talk about it, because I know it does help people. And but then, you know, rugby and the people within rugby, you know, people like yourselves, it's allowed people to be themselves, really. And that's why, you know, when people tell me, oh, you know, you can't be yourself in rugby, I say, yeah, yes, you can. You know, sometimes the issues may be with the individuals not accepting themselves who they are, which was something that I struggled with for many, many years. But it is nice, you know. I think the reason why I really started talking about it so openly was that I had my autobiography came out in 2008, the Welsh version, and then 2009 or 10, then the English version. And there's a couple of extracts in newspapers and stuff about it just after it had come out after the 2007 World Cup. And I had a letter from a lady from down just below Exeter, in a small village down there. And she wrote me this letter to say, look, you know, read your story, and like to thank you because you've actually saved my son's life. And it was quite a touching letter, really. And what had happened was her son had tried to take his own life. He was about 16 years of age. And he had a second chance like I did. And they obviously wouldn't say why. They didn't know why. So they were living in fear every day that he was going to do it again. And just after I'd come out and the announcements of the World Cup 2007 referee squad was done, there was a bit of a surprise in me and myself and Wayne Barnes were outsiders to be picked to go as referees, but they picked us to go. And the family had some friends over this evening, and I think the general conversation around the table was, have you heard they've picked the referees for the World Cup? And there's two surprises in there, Nigel Owens and Wayne Barnes are going. And the family friend said, oh, isn't Nigel Owens, isn't he the gay referee? And I think the father or mother said, yeah, he is. Oh, it doesn't matter, you know, as long as he's good enough to go to the World Cup, and it doesn't matter. So the son was hearing this. He didn't know nothing about me, so he heard my name, went upstairs, Googled it, read about it. And then the following day, plucked up the courage to tell his mum and dad, look, you know, exactly the same reason why Nigel Owens did it is exactly the same reason why I've done it. And he knew now that the language his mum and dad used around the table, he knew that he'd be okay, that they would accept him. And she wrote me a letter in thanking that it actually saved her son's life. And that really touched me, that did. And that sort of really is the main reason why I do speak about it now, because I know it does help people. And, you know, if I had somebody like that to talk about it openly when I was struggling with it, it would have helped me a lot and probably prevented me getting into that dark place as well, you know. So it is. And no matter what the issues are in your life, that's what I think is hugely important, that you talk about it, you share those worries, you know, and raising awareness of it by doing that. And I don't like using the word normalizing mental health, because I wish it wasn't about, so it wouldn't be normal. But the more normal people come about talking about it, it'll help a huge amount of people. And that's why I think it is important that we all share our journeys, really, and whatever the ups and downs along those journeys, because people can relate to it and it will help people hugely.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like for me, you know, the last 10 years, I'd look back and I don't know whether it's maturity levels or whatnot, but I definitely think it's easier now for a player to come out than it would have been back in 2008 or 2009. And, I suppose even in Ireland, you know, we were one of the first countries to have a referendum on allowing gay marriage, you know, back in, I think it was 2015, which was a big step forward as a country. And I think as well, like small things like, you know, wearing the rainbow laces, like for me as a 21, 22 year old, I wouldn't have thought a whole lot of it. You know, they get sent into the change room, you put them on, you're probably thinking, oh, they make my boots look a bit better. But as I got up, you know, a bit older, 27, 28, 29, and you know, you've people from the LGBT community coming up and saying, oh, look, I, you know, thanks for wearing those laces. It actually, it makes it easier for me to be involved in sport. It makes me more comfortable about the people that are doing it. And I think that ties into, you know, how people speak as well. Like even, you know, I think a big thing is, you know, personalities like yourself coming out, you know, it is huge for us. And I suppose one of the questions I'd have is like, what further changes would you like to see going forward? Or are there further improvements that you think can be made?
Yeah, I think there's always things that can improve, but I think it's a cultural thing and a society things as well. Like, you know, I think rugby is, look, there are things that rugby can do better. Rugby can't take the moral high ground above other sports because of things that rugby need to do better. But I think rugby certainly has led the way in inclusiveness and diversity within the sport. And, you know, if you look at, if there's one thing that today's society lacks, and that is respect. But rugby upholds the tradition and value of respect, you know, better than any other sport in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And because of that, it allows people to be themselves. And what you want then is the society to go the same way. But if you look at social media today, so there's some really horrible, horrible, nasty people out there. You know, you're thinking, oh, really, are there people like that about? And there are. So, you know, it's you need society to change as well as sort of rugby continuing to do the work that it does. And I think when you see people within sport, people that people look up to, I mean, whatever sport it is, when you see the way that they behave and conduct themselves, then that then contributes hugely then to the people around them in society in everyday life. So, I think it's, and it's not, you know, wearing the rainbow laces is not about sort of making a statement. It's about just showing people that you care, you know, that you're allies, you know, particularly for people who've, you know, been vindicated and been prejudiced against all their life, you know, when people, you know, having death threats, and in some countries, you know, you get the death sentence for it. So it's just showing people that people do care and people judge you for the person that you are and nothing else really. So, like, I just think rugby needs to continue doing the good work that it's doing, I think. And, you know, and in all fairness to Rugby Australia, you know, when the incident happened with Folau a couple of times, you know, they did the right thing. You know, it was called out and said, look, this is not acceptable. And if, you know, if you do this again, then, and that's what happened. You know, we did it again and there was no place for him in the sport because, you know, it is an inclusive sport. And, you know, everybody has his rights to his own opinion, but, you know, there are things that are not acceptable and there are consequences for your actions when you cross that line. So look, I think, you know, rugby has issues. It has issues in homophobia, racist, but it's a minority, you know, like in all walks of life. But I think what rugby does do, it deals with the issues. You know, it deals with issues that do arise. And I think that then does lead the way and show the way for other sports and other for society as well. I hope, you know, that things will change and people will not be judged on the color of the skin or their sexuality or their religious beliefs. They'll be judged on the content of the character and who they truly are as a person.
Amazing, Nigel. Thank you for that, and thank you for the work that you have been doing and I suppose raising the awareness across the world and across the board, not just in the rugby community. Nigel, while we have you, do you have time for a quick quiz, quick fire quiz?
Yeah, quick fire quiz, and then I'm going to have to go.
The game we play is taller, shorter, bigger, smaller. So it's literally exactly what it says on the tin. So we show you two rugby players and you guess whether they are taller or shorter or bigger or smaller. So taller, shorter is their height and bigger, smaller is their weight. So the first one I'm going to show you is Nigel. It's you talking to Sam Whitelock. Who do you think is bigger or smaller in this picture?
Well, if you're talking about wide around the waist, I'd be the big guy. But if you're talking about taller, then it'd be him. So the taller, I'd go.
So I haven't got his waist height, but I do have, according to Wikipedia, Sam is 6'6", while Nigel, you are
6'2", I think, am I? No, I'm about 5'10" and a half, I tell people. I'm probably pushing it a half, maybe. But so Sam Whitelock would be bigger, definitely.
So Sam definitely would be bigger there, Nigel. There you go. And now for the real deal. We'll keep going until you get one wrong, and then we'll add up your score at the end. Sean Cronin is currently top of the leaderboard on three. So first up, we want to know who is bigger or smaller. We have the Italian duo of Martin Gastro Giovanni and Sergio Parisa. Which man weighs more?
It's a bit tricky on this, isn't it? Because Parisi is quite taller, isn't he? Yeah, I think I'll go for... muscle weighs more than fat. Not I'm saying that Gastro Giovanni is fat, but I'll go for Parisi.
So Sergio does have a height advantage, but Gastro Giovanni is almost a stone heavier at 262 pounds, so that's 18 stone 10, while Parisi is 249 pounds, 17 stone 10.
Oh, last very long then. But I was counting Parisi before he lost his hair, mind. That may make a difference.
That's very, very true. Do you want one more just to say that you've got at least one question correct?
Yeah.
So moving on, we have the Munster pair of Peter Stringer and Craig Casey. Nigel, who do you think is taller and shorter?
Oh, Craig Casey, I refereed him. He plays now. I refereed him against Edinburgh a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, blonde-haired.
He's short. Yeah. I think I said when I was on the field that he was short. Oh, my God.
A long time since you saw Stringer on the field. It's hard to know.
Stringer was
50-50 chance here, Nigel.
Yeah, this is. There's not much between these two. I will go for Stringer is the shortest.
No.
Your memory has gone. While Stringer is 1.71 metres, the same as Chelsea Colby, he is taller than Craig Casey, who is 165. So Craig Casey is only a mere 5'5". Very small.
He was very small. Yeah, I got that wrong. I'm hopeless. I was on the chase a few weeks ago. I was hopeless of that. I'm hopeless of this as well.
You have to stick to the farming and the refereeing, Nigel, and stay away from all those game shows and the quizzes.
Yeah, I'll try to.
Anyway, so, Nigel, it's been fabulous having you on. Thank you so much for spending the time to chat to myself and Ian here. So thank you for coming on to House of Rugby here on Joe together with Guinness.
Yeah. Thanks a million, Nigel. Look forward to catching up.
Hey, pleasure. Again. Yeah. See you next week.
House of Rugby Ireland here on Joe together with Guinness. Game changed.